Please have a seat. Came across a story this week. This bus driver working his way down a route, and he gets to a spot and a stop, and this really big guy gets on. We're talking 6'8", built like a wrestler. And he looked at the bus driver and he said, "Big John doesn't pay." Well, the bus driver's like 5'6", 150, and he is really scared, so he isn't going to say a word. He just kind of backs up. Big John walks to his seat, and the bus driver hopes, "I really hope this is like I never see him again." But sure enough, he's working his way toward that bus stop the next day, and there he is, and he starts to feel the fear. Big John gets on. Big John doesn't pay, and the poor bus driver can hardly sleep. He's so afraid, thinking every day, and decides, "I'm going to do something about this." So he buys some weights, and he looks at videos on bodybuilding, and he takes a self-defense course, and he even learns what should it look like to confront, and he does all of this, and finally he is ready, feeling buff and strong. Big John gets on that next day and says, "Big John doesn't pay." Bus driver gets up and says, "Oh yeah? Why not?" Big John looked at him and said, "Well, Big John has a bus pass." Well, there's a story of a whole lot of fear that could have been dealt with if it had just got to the truth and looked at things as they really are. It reminds me of something Nicky Gumbel, he does a Bible through the year. And when he talks about fear, I've seen him do this a few times, he gives an acronym for fear, and often these are a little cheesy, but this one works. He says you take the letters of fear, and they can be seen as false evidence appearing real. False evidence appearing real. Now, Nicky Gumbel says that there are times where fear is a good thing. It's an emotion that can be very healthy. If you're moving toward, there's a stop sign and you're moving through, you don't have it, but someone is sliding, it's probably a good thing to be a little afraid and take some action. Or the prof says, "Hey, you know that next couple chapters in the book, they are going to be on the exam." A little bit of fear that says, maybe I should actually read these. That might be a good thing. But there's a world of difference between fearful circumstances that we look at honestly, we look at the evidence and we make decisions. There's a world of difference between that and overestimating the threat and underestimating the truth and the resources that God makes available. We're living in a time when you listen to reports about mental health, when fear is all around us. And it might be fear of the virus, getting it, giving it, fear of a lot of the news. There's just so much uncertainty and chaos, disorder. It might be fear in your own life, conflict, situations with people that just, you don't know where they're going to go. Fear at the job, fear of the economy, fear of finances, on and on it goes. And if we focus on that fear, as Geraldine told Hamilton, can get us all in a knot. I am so grateful. God just doesn't say, "Do not be afraid," but He gives us truth to make a solid place to stand, that we don't have to be slaves to fear. Today, let's look at this, because there's so many places in the Bible where God confronts fear. And we've been in Isaiah, and we come to a spot where God's people are afraid. I think there's like four times in Isaiah 41, God says, "Do not be afraid." Here's Isaiah 41:10. "Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed. I am your God." Here's the situation. And if you've been here recent weeks, you know. The people of God have not followed God. God says there will be consequences, and they were, and they end up in exile in Babylon. They never thought their temple would be destroyed. It's been destroyed. They never thought Jerusalem, the city of God, would be destroyed. It's destroyed. And now they're miles away in Babylon. Not only that, but we read in chapter 41 where Isaiah is now prophetically looking at the events that are going to happen. And he says, not only are you going to be in Babylon, but the nations are going to shake. And Babylon itself is going to be taken over from Persia. Isaiah 41:2, who has stirred up one from the east, calling him in righteousness to his service? His hands subdue nations over him. He subdues kings before him. He turns them to dust with his sword, to windblown chaff with his bow. Isaiah is looking toward a day when Babylon, the mighty nation that has taken you into exile, will be overcome by another one. It's going to be Persia. So you're already this insignificant group of exiles with no power, and now another big nation has come in, and what are they going to do? Uncertainty, fear. I want us to look at the importance of the little word for in verse 10. Do not fear. For I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. You see, I think a lot of times we think it's up to us to create the strength to put in the noodle so that we work up the courage. But God says, no. I am asking you not to fear and not to be dismayed, not on the basis of you, but on the basis of me and my truth. I am with you. I am your God. And in the context of chapter 41 of Isaiah, really, he gives assurance under two main themes. The first one is, I've got this. The second one is, I've got you. I've got this. Do not be afraid. I've got you. Let's look at what those two mean. First of all, what does it mean that God is saying to them, in the midst of the fearful circumstances and the nation shaking, I've got this? Let me get at this. This is a story I've told a few times. It's a famous Chuck Swindoll story. He tells about Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States, who was traveling on horseback with a group. And they get to what should have been a bridge over a river, but there had been a huge flood, and the river had overflooded its banks, taken out the bridge. It is still flowing high and swift, and these people have to go across on horseback. Well, as the story goes, there's a person walking who's been waiting for someone he can go across with, and this group gets there, and he has a good look at them all, and he says to the president, can I go across with you? Can I get on your horse with you? Jefferson said yes, and they went across, and he gets off on the other side, and someone in the party says, how on earth did you ask the president to take you across the river? He said, I didn't know he was a president. He said, all I know is I took a really good look at all of those who were sitting on the horses, and a lot of them had no faces. That man had a yes face. That man had a yes face. The ultimate yes face in the universe belongs to God. That's what it means when he said, I've got this. It's fascinating. Isaiah 41, it begins by comparing, what are the nations doing? As Persia is now coming and becoming the world power, what's going on in the faces of the rulers all around? And so we read in verse 5. The islands, which the language there is the far-flung parts of the world. Okay, on the edges of what was on the Babylonian Empire, even out there on the edges, they've seen it. They see what's coming. They see the threat and they fear. The ends of the earth tremble. around that known world, there are no faces among all the leaders. They're turning to their gods, and there's this one saying they're even trying to nail the feet of their gods so their gods aren't going to topple. Even their gods have no faces. And then opposed to that, we get Isaiah 41:10. Do not fear, for I am your God. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. That word right hand, when you see it in the Bible, it means God's power. My right hand holds all power in the universe. That's the saying. And again, on what basis can God say that? Well, let's go up to verse 4. Where God is actually saying, you know who's behind Persia? Verse 4, he says, who has done this and carried it through, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, with the first of them and with the last, I am he. Now, whenever you see the Lord, you got to ask, is this a translation of the word Yahweh? And here it is. I am Yahweh. Now, what does that mean? God is wanting them to know, I am Yahweh. It's the name when Moses was about to lead his people and he's scared spitless because Egypt's so big. And he said, God, you want me to go there? What do I tell him is your name? And God said, I am who I am, Yahweh. I am who I am. I've always existed. I exist now. I will always exist. I am. One Hebrew scholar, John Oswald, has said, when he says I am, it's a statement of self-existence and self-identity. God says he is the one who is. Every other life form on this planet is derivative. Everything on this planet, in this universe that is not God, comes from God because he is I am. Babylon comes from God. Persia comes from God. And he's saying, I've got this. Even in that statement, I am who I am, it takes them back to when they were in Egypt in slavery. And God said, you have the height of power of that day over you, and you seem to have no hope. God says, I've got this. And Moses came and the plagues, and you were released, and then you get to the Red Sea. And you got an army behind you, the Egyptian army, and just water, and there's nowhere to go. And God says, I've got this. That sea is mine, and it parts. And you go across. There's always two horizons. I am. I've got this. And so, yes, God was in control when Persia came because it was under Persia that they would be released from exile. And in the beginning of three or four waves of people allowed to go back to Jerusalem. But the second horizon where God continues to say, I got this, the hour that looked the darkest is when Jesus dies on a cross. And God in his power says, I got this. And Easter morning, Jesus rises from the dead. There is no situation you face where God does not have a yes face. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to make things work out the way we want them to. But it just means God says, I have a plan, and it's a good plan. And I've got this. And whether that plan means things are going to work out tomorrow, or you're going to know my presence over a long period of time, or whether they're going to work out eternally and you're going to find yourself freed from all that's going on in this life. I've got this. Don't be afraid. Which leaves us thinking, okay, but it's an awfully big world you've got. You're dealing with players like Egypt and Babylon and Persia. It's just little old me. In the midst of everything going on, might you be forgetting me? And the second truth of the passage, God says, no. Not only have I got this, I've got you. I've got you. See, part of the reason I wanted to tell that story again about the yes face is the little piece where you got the president and this unknown person saying, is there room on your saddle for me? And he said, yeah, come on up. Not only am I confident we're going across, but come with me. I will bring you across to whatever my purposes are for you. I've got this. I've got you. Let's go back to Isaiah 41:10. Do not fear, for I am with you. And here he's speaking to, yes, the people in exile, his people collectively, but also each one within that people. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you. This is the mind-blowing truth of Scripture, that the God of the universe, and the big theological word is transcendence, is a God who knows each of our situations personally. And the big theological word is immanence. He's transcendent. He's immanent. Lord of all, involved in each one of our lives. Now, what's fascinating is watching how this works itself out. Because there's essentially two implications of this when it comes to handling our fear. The first one of him personally working with us is this. We don't need to retreat in self-protection. We can actually, because he's at work in our lives, move forward. Take the next step. Think about how to engage the world around us instead of retreat from the world around us, which is what fear does. We can actually engage the world. Impact all of those circumstances. It is interesting how fear makes our world smaller. I came across this study. 1975, a guy went to a small town in Vermont, is where he did the study. 86 children between 3 and 12. He with his team, just kind of followed them around this small town, mapped out where they went. In 1986, he discovered that these kids had remarkable freedom. They had the run of the town, basically. And as he interviewed their parents, the parents weren't worried about that. 39 years later, 2014, he goes back to the town. A lot of those kids are now parents. Others have moved in, and he begins to follow the children in that town. And guess what? When they're alone, they basically just stay on their property. Parents don't want them to go alone beyond the property. But what is interesting, truth is, the crime rate in that little town was exactly what it was in 1975. But a scary world had reduced the people's lives to something so small that now we protect ourselves, we pull back, we hunker in. We preserve. Now, I'm not going to comment here about parenting in our day. That's not it. But I think we all know that when we're afraid, our human tendency is to preserve, to pull in, to protect. And God says, engage. Here's how he does it. Verse 41:14. Do not be afraid. There it is again. Do not be afraid, you worm Jacob. Little Israel, do not fear, for I myself will help you, declares the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Now, when he calls them, you worm, what they're saying is this was their self, this is how they saw themselves in their fear. Helpless, little. Where do you find a worm? In the ground, hiding. Don't be afraid. You see yourselves as a worm, as little, but how does God see you? Verse 15, see, I will make you into a threshing sledge, new and sharp with many teeth. You will thresh the mountains and crush them and reduce the hills to chaff. What's going on? A threshing sledge was wood with rocks, sharp rocks attached. And they would push it over grain and it would separate the wheat from the chaff. God says, I'm going to make you the kind of a threshing sledge that actually goes over mountains and reduces it to chaff. You can have an impact far beyond what you can imagine. You don't need to retreat like a worm in the ground. You can actually look around and say, God, where are you leading me? What's my next step in this? How do you want me to engage the world? I can't take it all on, but God, who are the people around me? What's their fear? How can I enter into their lives? How can I care? He's already told them, and we covered this last week, that when you're in Babylon, settle down. Pray for the peace and prosperity of where you're at. Get involved. Don't become an isolated subculture. Look beyond yourselves. And God can actually use you. And then you watch history unfold. The story of Daniel in the lion's den is under Darius, the king of Persia. Daniel is now the third in the land. Oh, little worm Jacob, I'll make you a threshing sledge. One of you is going to be one of the top three advisors in the land. And because you're spared from a lion, is actually going to make the king acknowledge who's God for that time. Queen Esther. King is Xerxes, a Persian. Oh, worm, Israel, one of you is going to be queen. And through that, save your people. Oh, Nehemiah. The king was Artaxerxes, Persian. Yeah, Nehemiah, you're going to actually have a pretty high civil servant job, cupbearer to the king, and king's going to have favor on you so that you're going to be able to go back with another whole wave of people. Rebuild the walls. God's plan in the midst of a world that's shaking is to establish these outposts of his kingdom where each of us live and work. And we're not worms. Saying, open your eyes. What does it look like to bring the presence and the heart and the hope and the voice and the hands and the feet of Jesus? Where the world wants to hunker down in fear, God is saying, what are the opportunities? But you might say, okay, but whoa, I'm so small. Well, God says, yeah, but I'll supply. And that's the second truth. The fact that he says, I've got you, means you don't have to hunker down. You can actually engage life. And I'll supply the heavy lifting. I know what you need in the midst of that. Self-preservation is all about, I've got to take care of my own needs. God says, no, I'll take care of your needs. Go live for me. Verses 17 and 18. The poor and the needy search for water, but there is none. Their tongues are parched with thirst, but I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I'll make rivers flow on barren heights, springs within valleys. I'll turn deserts into pools of water, parched ground into springs. Rivers flow on barren heights? Heights? Rivers flow in the valleys. No, God says even where it doesn't look like resources can come and work can happen, I'll do it. I can work in the deserts. Whatever you need, God says, I can provide. You know, it's funny. I think it's Capital One has the commercials, right? What's in your wallet? And the message is, if you have a Capital One credit card in your wallet, it doesn't matter what you need. There's provision. You know what it doesn't tell you is you better have the bank account behind it, right? Or you're going to be paying like 20% interest. God says, you know what's in your wallet? I am. I am. Hey, look how this worked itself out. It was under Persia that the exiles got to go back. The first wave was under King Cyrus. Let me just read some of this. Isaiah 1, 5 to 7. Then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. All their neighbors assisted them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with valuable gifts, in addition to all the freewill offerings. Moreover, King Cyrus brought out the articles belonging to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and had placed in the temple of his God. Okay, we read that and we go, okay, think about it. You're already exiles in a land. A new government comes in. And now, what's your place? And the king says, you can go back. Oh, by the way, usually when that happens, a refugee gets out with the shirt on his back, and that's it. But by the way, you can take whatever you've accumulated. And if your neighbors don't go with you, see what they want to send with you. Do you see that? All the wealth that's been accumulated here at home, you can take. Kind of unheard of. Oh! I remember that when that king we took over, when he took your temple, he brought a bunch of gold back. Why don't you take that too? Really? Really? Several decades later, Nehemiah goes back, this time to rebuild the wall. It's another king, Artaxerxes. So Nehemiah says to that king, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so they'll provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. It's kind of the Wild West, all right? And Nehemiah's going to be going with a bunch of people, and he's just, I need some protection here. So he asks the king, can you kind of go ahead of me? May I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so he'll give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall. Oh, and king, I need some wood. Verse 9, so, and because of the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my request. Verse 9, so I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. Oh, by the way, the king also had sent army officers and cavalry with me. Do you see that? Oh, God, I could never make a difference or engage in the midst of the fearful circumstances. I'm just a worm. And God says, well, okay, I'm God. I know what you need. I'll do the heavy lifting. So in times of fear, God is saying, I've got this. What looks like chaos to you is not chaos to me. I'm the I Am. All those nations, all the people involved, everything going on, it's derivative. I'm God. World history is going somewhere. Trust me. And in the meantime, I know you're afraid. This is the grace of God saying, do not be afraid. He knows we're human. He knows we feel the emotion. So he comes again and again, and he says, do not be afraid. But there's always with, do not be afraid, some message of who he is. Do not be afraid. I've got you. You don't need to hunker down. You don't need to live in self-protection and preservation. But you can actually trust me to engage. Who are the people around you? What are places you can come with the love and the grace and the truth of God? Not in the world's way, demanding, but the way of the cross, loving. God says, then trust me. You may see fruit, you may not. But trust that I'm working. And oh, by the way, remember the second horizon. The greatest fear in all of this is, human standpoint, I'm going to die. But God says, I've provided for that too. And out of the return from exile, that nation reestablishes. Jesus is born, goes to a cross, dies again. And because of the resurrection and the offer of forgiveness and life, what does he say? 1 Corinthians 15. The sting of death is sin. The power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. He's saying, even if the worst thing on earth happens, you have victory. It's an eternal perspective. It changes everything. Maybe in your world today, Big John is saying, I'm not going to pay, and you're shaking. What causes this to strengthen is not us working up courage. It's looking at what's true. When false evidence appears real, we forget God. When we bring in the truth of God, do not fear, for I'm with you. Do not be afraid, I'm your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. I've got this. I've got you. Let's pray. Father, I think it's easy sometimes for us to just read, do not fear, and we think it's up to us to create our own courage. But your word says, do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. My right hand is at work. I am the great I am. Part of your way out of fear, it's not going to be in hiding, but in living. And seeing me provide in the midst of the steps that maybe are fearful to take, and yet they're never taken alone. You are that peace. We're going to sing it. When sorrows, when fears, like waves roll, the river looks high, we look at you and we say a yes face. We look at you and your arms are saying, come on and sit on my saddle. Let's go in this together. Because that's true, it can be well with your soul.